Hi, everyone, and welcome to One Question with Pastor Adam. And I'm Adam, and I'm pastor to believers and doubters, to unfaithful Christians and faithful atheists. And friends, Jesus wasn't afraid of questions, and neither are we. So each week on this podcast, we're going to explore one question that you've sent me over Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or now on TikTok. So friends, I'm just so grateful and honored and humbled in like one of those, oh my gosh, I can't believe I get to do this kind of ways, because today we get to talk with Brian McLaren. Brian is a good friend, a good mentor, has written so many amazing books, but we're going to talk with Brian about this one, Faith After Doubt: Why Your Beliefs Stopped Working and What to Do About It. And we're a little bit late. We had a few technical difficulties, so we're just going to jump right into it. I'm going to bring Brian in. Hi, Brian.
Hey, so glad we sorted out our technical difficulties.
I'm so glad to. Thank you for being here. And thank you, everybody, for being here and for sticking with us as we work through the technical difficulties. Brian, you're going to be able to see some comments in the comment section over there on the side. And we might, as always, this is conversational. So if you're watching, you can put in comments and questions. But Brian, this book was so important for me to read for all of the things that we are going through at my particular church, and also just what Christianity is going through in the present moment. And I can't recommend it highly enough. It is such an important book. And so thank you for writing it.
Oh, thanks so much for reading it. And obviously you know, it means a lot when you hear that something you worked on is helping. So that's great to hear.
Like, I know that, like, I've listened to a few podcasts that you've done with other folks about this book, and it's just phenomenal what you've done here. It's one of the things that is so important for me as I was reading it is this sense of shame that we have that's centered around doubts. And you not only give an invitation to say, hey, doubting is okay, you actually say that doubting is essential to our faith. And you even go beyond that. I wrote this down and I had to read it a couple of times, Brian, because I thought it was just so phenomenal the way you put it. You say this on page 113, only doubt can save the world. And that is such a radical statement and rings so true to me, especially during these times. But how have you come to the point where you are able to say not only should you doubt, but it's doubt that is going to save us?
Yeah. Well, so there are a couple angles we could come at this from. Let me try a Christian angle and then just a general human angle. So we Christians, you know, we take Jesus seriously, and Jesus shows up on the scene, and in his most famous address called the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "You have heard it said," yes. And then he says, "But I say to you," he says it, I think, five times. So it's very, very clear that what Jesus was about was asking people to doubt what they have heard, to doubt what they were taught, to doubt what everybody says and what everybody knows. And it really, to me, it reaches a crescendo when he finally says, look, you've heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. I say to you, love your enemy. And so he's saying, doubt the rules you've been taught, doubt the proverbial conventional wisdom you've been taught, doubt how people have interpreted and applied the scriptures. I'm asking you to give those ideas a second thought. And in fact, the word repent, you know, pent means thought and re means again. So give it a second thought. Think about it again. Be willing to question it. So unless you think that you're already perfect and you have everything figured out and that you have no misconceptions, then we need doubt to be able to give second thoughts to things that we currently accept that are wrong, right? And that are unhelpful and so on. That applies in the Christian context. Even though it's very painful, I think, for a lot of Christians to admit that. But I'll tell you, I have a friend who's an economist, and he is not a religious person. And we were talking on the phone. In fact, we were talking on Zoom one day. And he says, Brian, he said, you think religious people are fundamentalists? Wait till you get around economists. And, you know, when we think about the crises we face in the world, climate change, economic inequality, political corruption, all of which are related to money and economics, you realize if we just keep saying what we've always said, if we don't have doubts about the way we're doing things, well, we're going to drive ourselves right off a cliff. So we're going to be, you know, a civilization doing a Thelma and Louise. And so that, yeah. So I really believe that. Now look, there's a truth so they can follow a conspiracy theory. That's not what I'm talking about.
We've got a few comments. Craig says, that makes sense since certainty has become dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the old saying? You know, it's not what you don't know that will get you. It's what you know, but you're wrong about. And so that kind of certainty that's unwilling to ever question, you know, we've all met people like this. We've met that husband who bosses his spouse around and is always sure that he's right, always sure she's wrong. We've met that parent who barks at their children. The parent is never has a touch of doubt that except that he understands or she understands everything that's going on. That kind of doubt, that kind of certainty, it's very comfortable, I suppose, but it can harm a lot of people.
Yeah. Amber says, doubt has played the most pivotal turning point, not only in my faith, but also in the character of my soul. Doubt drove me to love more, assume goodness of others more. Doubt made me want the kingdom on earth more.
Mm-hmm. That's so powerfully said. You know, I was talking about this book with a pastor actually not too long ago. And, you know, in the book, I talk about stages, and the transition from each stage to the next involves a period of doubt where we doubt that the operating system of our current approach is not the only one. But when we get to stage three that I call perplexity, that's really a deep period of doubt. And this fellow said to me, I know exactly the moment when I entered stage three. He said it was when my baby was born. She was premature. She was in intensive care. And he said, I was in the intensive care and I had my hand in the, I don't know what they call them, the incubator or whatever that, you know, that special container is. And my hand is there and my little tiny baby is holding my finger. And he said, I felt so much love for her. I felt so much love for her that instantly I thought any God who would be willing to torture one of God's own children is not a big enough God. Love is way too powerful for that. And that reminds me of what Amber said. You know, in a sense, his experience of love made him doubt a vision of God that wasn't loving enough. And that increased his freedom to love.
This is one of the reasons that I love this book. And I love your essence, your spirit, and all of your books, is that you're able to tell these really powerful, engaging stories along with giving us theory. Like you've already talked about the four stages of doubt and how they move us forward into more stages. But you combine this, the theory, with these beautiful stories like the one that you just gave. And it just makes it's a breath of fresh air. It's really compelling reading. And I thought that maybe we could start with you telling your own story about what led you into a sense of doubt. I know that you've been struggling with this, or I don't know if struggle is the right word. You've been managing or playing with doubt. Maybe playful is a more, is a better term to use for it, but for much of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I grew up in a super conservative Christian setting. My parents were wonderful people, but our religious setting was, you know, we thought Billy Graham was a liberal. We, you know, we were really far, far, far on the right. And for example, one of the first sort of experiences of doubt that hit me, I was one of those kids who loved animals and loved plants. And I went to the library and checked out all the books on science. And by the time I was 8 or 10 years old, like I was reading about evolution and it made perfect sense. I would see, you know, yeah, this looks like a modification of that. And it made perfect sense. And then I was told in church that we couldn't believe in evolution. We either believe in God or evolution. I remember hearing sermons about how horrible Charles Darwin was and that he was of the devil and all the rest. Of course, I'm sure these people had never read a word by Charles Darwin. They were just passing on sort of the hostility that they had been taught, you know. So it was at a young age where I thought, just because they teach it in my church doesn't make it true. Mm. And I said, I'm going to have to reserve some private space. Like, I knew enough not to bring it up to my Sunday school teacher. It wasn't that he was a bad person. He was just passing on what he'd been taught. And if I brought up something, I just think it would have, you know, caused trouble. So I had to reserve a little private room of my brain to say, I know that's what they believe around here, but I don't think so. So that really has been has been with me since I was a kid, you know. And I became a pastor and got involved in religious circles. And something happens when you're a pastor, you know about this. You see behind the curtain and you see these people who are so polished and together on Sunday morning. And then you realize they're just human beings and they've got their prejudices and bigotries and limitations like anybody else. And so you realize that that you can't just believe something because somebody else said so. In fact, one of the things I've become convinced of is that faith is not the enemy of doubt. I'm sorry, doubt is not the enemy of faith, but doubt is the enemy of authoritarianism. Because it's those authoritarian people who want to tell you, believe what I tell you. And if you ask questions, they mock you, they insult you, they threaten you. In other words, they want you to believe just based on force and power, or they bribe you if you will believe, and they threaten you if you know, rewards and punishments, all that. And you realize this just is not a safe world to just accept things because somebody else told you that's the way it has to be.
The description that you just gave about authoritarianism is a description, as you were talking about it, that I have heard a lot of atheists use for God.
Yes.
This is the reason to reject God. And maybe we're jumping ahead of ourselves, but this is the third stage.
Yes.
It seems to me, right?
Yeah.
The third stage where you start doubting everything. It's where a lot of us are, is in deconstruction.
Yes.
Could you say a little bit about the deconstruction phase?
Sure. Well, if we think of stages one and two as a construction phase,
yes.
First we construct with dualism in stage one, simplicity. We learn to construct, this is right, that's wrong, this is safe, that's dangerous, this is a friend, that's an enemy, you know, this is familiar, that's weird. We put everything in these categories. I like it, I dislike it. And you know, that's part of growing up and that's part of having a brain and all the rest. So we learn that. Sadly, a lot of people, their religious setting never lets them grow beyond that. That's all that religion is. And God is the stage one authority figure who's up there to punish you if you do wrong and to reward you if you do right. And that's as far as it goes. And a lot of people are very comfortable there their whole lives. But and I don't see these as stages like, you know, you run 1 mile and then another mile. I see these as like rings on a tree. Each ring grows out of the other one and expands into new capacities. And so in the second constructive stage, complexity, we think, okay, now I've got the basics down. Now I want information. Now I'm curious. Now I want to learn how to study and do things and know things and learn things on my own. And so we're interested in just accumulating data and accumulating information and know-how and skill. But many of us get to a point at the end of stage two where we say, you know, those people who are telling us all those easy answers and easy rules and those people who are filling us with information, they got some blind spots. In fact, they've got vested interest in why they do what they do. In fact, if you study in history, they've hurt a lot. They've killed a lot of people. Those ways of thinking have been dangerous. We got to go back and sift through everything we've been taught because it's polluted and it's corrupt and it's a mixed bag. You know, it's not saying that it's all bad, but we've got to sort it through. And, you know, the people in stage one and stage two say, oh, those are bad people. They're throwing out the truth. But they don't understand the people in stage three who are doing that deconstruction. This is an ethical quest. This is a quest to stop harming people. This is a quest to be honest and have integrity. And so that's why stage three, I think, is, and in some ways, this is a book especially for people in stage three, because they're the ones who are suffering, especially in religious settings.
And one of the next stage four, you've called harmony.
Yes.
And early on in the book, you tell this amazing story about how you were at a college giving a talk. And the first person to stand up was clearly not a student.
Yes.
It was a pastor from the community who may have been in stage one, maybe stage two, right? It seems like. But he's what you call in the book a gatekeeper.
Yes.
Someone who says, Brian, why don't you just admit that you're a heretic? You're making up your own religion. I've heard this too, and I struggle with it. But your response to it was a brilliant, beautiful example of stage four of harmony, I thought. And could you just kind of tell that story of that experience that you had?
Well, yeah, this fellow is really hostile. And, you know, I've learned through the years that many times when people they come out of the gate hostile, I realize they're either trying to punish me because I've said something that unsettled them, or they're actually trying to convince themselves. And the way that they convince themselves is by being a warrior, you know. And so I don't even remember exactly what I said to him, except that I tried to, you know, I tried to not get in a fight with him. It was obvious he wanted to be heard. He didn't so much want to have a conversation, and he'd already listened to me speak. But what really shocked me is after the event, he comes up in line, and he's right in the front of the line too. And he says to me, I'd like your email address. And I got to tell you, I never give my email address to people. It's just too dangerous. And I've had people do some very vicious things. And so, but I just felt sort of a little flick in the head that I should trust this guy. So I gave it to him, and I can't remember if it was the next day or 2 days later, but I have an email waiting for me. You know, Brian, I'm the person who asked you that question. I'm sure you remember me. And then he said, what do you say to a pastor who is losing his faith? I am that pastor. And suddenly everything flipped around. I realized his attack on me was in some ways a test. Is this guy, to whatever degree I passed it, he felt he could trust me with his deep secret, you know? That just tells us that behind the scenes, there's a lot more going on than people realize.
How did you get to that point where you are able to receive this, as you say, hostility, and not respond with hostility back? Like, I can imagine if it was me, I'd be like, hey, you.
Well, there's a.
You shouldn't use in church.
Yeah, well, let's say, first of all, you know, I'm not a fighter. You know, some people are fighters. I'm not a fighter. But the truth and my truth that I felt I needed to speak, and my message that I felt I needed to speak, has been seen. A lot of people have seen it as controversial. And so, you know, I've received a lot of criticism through the years. Yeah. So in some ways, the answer to that is I've had practice. But the truth is, one of my mentors once we were together. And he gave me, I don't know if you remember Ditto paper. Do you remember Ditto machines? You're probably too young for them. But before Xerox and photocopying and all that, it was a way of duplicating. And it had this blue ink that smelled, had a certain alcohol smell to it. I can smell it as I think of it now. So it was really old. It had been duplicated so long ago. But he gave it to me and he said, I have a feeling you're going to need this. And it was a prayer by a Serbian Orthodox bishop. This bishop had been captured by the Nazis and put in a concentration camp. And when he was in prison, all he could think of is, I only spoke against the Nazis to some of the priests under my care. One of my own priests turned me into the Nazis. I bet it was him. And apparently he was just filled with hatred, and he thought, here I am, I could die. I'm a Christian, I'm a bishop, and I'm filled with hatred. What's wrong with me? And so he wrestles through this into a prayer. And that's the prayer that this fellow gave me. And all I can say is it's saved my life in a lot of ways. You know, I'll just give you an example. The prayer has this refrain: bless my enemies, O Lord, even I bless them and do not curse them. And there's one line that always comes to me. It says, just as a hunted animal finds safer shelter than an unhunted animal, so I, having been pursued by my enemies, have found the safest shelter in the shadow of your wings. So he was basically saying, I've decided to let the attacks of my enemies draw me closer to God. And all I can say is that that's played a big part. If people are interested, if you go on my website, brianmclaren.net, and put in the little search box, prayer for enemies, I'm sure that will come up.
That's beautiful. Do you find that the people who tend to be the most outspoken, like this man, this pastor who was there almost attacking you, do you find that they tend to be the ones who are merging into doubt? And does that help you have a little more compassion for them?
Sometimes they're just people whose ego has been attached to an idea in such a deep way that any attack on that idea, they take as an attack on them. And so then they're hurt and they respond with revenge or you and I know something about, you know, this concept of rivalry. They think, my idea, I want to win. This idea sounds good. I've got to beat it down. I've got to make sure my idea conquers. Sometimes I think these folks have no doubt at all. They're absolutely psychologically certain that they're right. But there are times when the people who fight the hardest are on the verge of having the whole thing fall apart, and they're working so hard to try to keep it together, which makes them, you know, maybe anxious or a little crabby.
You talk about this a bit, and I have noticed it as well, that the loudest people in the religious room, whether we're talking about Christians, Muslims, maybe even Jews, tend to be the folks who are most known for being in stage one.
Yeah.
The most who are right and wrong, good and bad, and they're the loudest people in the room.
Yeah.
How have you been able to find your voice in a room that is that loud of who's right, who's wrong? How have you been? Because I think this is so crucial for us who are trying to transform the landscape of Christianity. How do we increase our voice without getting stuck in the, they're the bad guys and good guys? Or another way to put this is, in liberal progressive congregations, we like to say, we're ashamed of calling ourselves Christians because we want to be like those Christians.
Yes. Yeah. Well, oh my goodness. Such a good question. I think I'd start, Adam, by saying that I can tell you, to use this language of stages, simplicity, complexity, perplexity, harmony, you know, there are Jews who are so deep in harmony, and there are Muslims who are so deep in harmony, and and you know, humanists and atheists and Hindus who are so deep in harmony. And all of them feel the same way as we Christians do. They feel more in common with other people in harmony in other traditions than they do with those loud voices of simplicity within their own tradition. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with being in simplicity. I think when simplicity gets ugly and loud is when people actually grow into stage two or stage three, and then they are afraid and they jump back. And because, you know, and that adds a certain amount of desperation to that. They feel under threat. And I think what, in terms of how I found my voice, I think I lowered my expectations. I realized that I wasn't going to convince anybody who wasn't ready for it. And if they are ready for it, I'm probably not that important, but I'll do what I can, you know? And so what that means is you don't expect to win anything. You just try to bear witness to what you've seen and heard and experienced. And you, in a sense, it's an act not of aggression, like I'm going to defeat your idea. It's an act of vulnerability. I'm going to say what I think, and I might be wrong, and I'm going to listen to what you have to say. But I'm not going to pretend if what I think you say isn't satisfying. I'm not going to pretend it's satisfying, but I'm going to engage in conversation without needing to win. It's so funny. I remember the moment I learned this. Back in the days when we flew before COVID, I was in an airport and a flight had been canceled and there was bad weather and I had to get my itinerary changed. And there's this long line. And you know how people just get frustrated in these long lines, especially because you think I'm about to miss the next flight I can get. And somebody walks right up, and I'm the second person in line. Somebody walks up to the front of the line and just steps in front of the guy. And the guy in front of me taps the fellow on the shoulder and says, "Excuse me, I hate it when people do what you just did." And that's all he said. He didn't say, "You're an idiot." He just says, "I hate it." And the guy didn't leave the line. He went and got treated next. And the fellow turned around. I said to the fellow, "Good for you for speaking up." He said, "I've just learned the power of a non-directive statement." That's what he said to me. I didn't tell him what to do. I just let him know how I felt about what he did. And I think there's something when we stop trying to tell people what to do and we just try to speak. And, you know, so interesting in the Christian background I come from, we call this bearing witness to how you feel, to what you see, not telling people they're wrong, but just telling what I've seen. So that's, I think, what I try to do. And I'm sure I blow it a lot.
That's awesome. I want to read a couple of comments. Michael has asked, I don't know if you've ever been asked this on a podcast, Brian, but Michael asks if near the end of our time, if you can play us a song.
Well, I've got some instruments behind me, but I don't think, I think I better save us from all that.
But, okay. But Michael also says, when the roof of our house of faith is blown off, that's when we're able to see the stars.
That's beautifully said. Yeah, there are things you don't see. In fact, one of my other mentors says, what you focus on determines what you miss. Mm. And sometimes having things fall apart, we start seeing what we've been missing.
Wow. Craig thinks that he was there at that school where that happened. Craig may have been there, yeah. Rick mentions one of your good friends, Phyllis Tickle, who you quote in the book on the Great Emergence, which concluded that Western Church is in the midst of a 500-year period of reforming on par with the Calvin and Luther helped to foster five centuries ago. I'm wondering how your framework with the process of doubt and faith might connect with the epical shift Mrs. Tickle identified in our time.
Well, look, I don't have any idea whether what I and other friends who are working in similar veins, I have no idea of what we're saying and doing will work in the sense of, I mean, I know it works for me, but whether it will catch on in sufficient ways. But here's what I can say. it's not just a matter of fixing the doctrines. It's not just a matter of changing beliefs. It's a matter of taking beliefs out of the driver's seat and maybe putting beliefs back in the trunk, or maybe even in a trailer behind the vehicle. And, you know, as you know from reading the book, a scripture that I sort of lift up as being, I think, really important that doesn't get paid attention to a lot is from Galatians, where Paul says, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything at all. And of course, you know, for people who aren't familiar with this, you don't even know what that's, what is that about? But, you know, this is like the boundary marker of who's in and who's out. That's what that means. And for the ancient Jews, it was circumcision. For modern day Christians, it's beliefs. The boundary markers that you're arguing about don't mean anything at all. The only thing that matters is faith expressing itself in love. So suddenly now love goes into the driver's seat. And if what we're working on now gains purchase, then that will be a really significant reformation. It will shift all the focus to how do we become people who join the love of God and the God of love in expressing love in this world.
How would you describe love? Because here's what I'm running into. I am going to tell you that you are sinning because yes. I love you.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm doing this as an act. I'm telling you that you're wrong as an act of love.
Yes. Yes.
So how do we redefine love? How is that? Here, I'm going back to my stage one. Brian, please tell me that that's wrong. And
well, in fact, the stage language really helps because that's all that a stage one person can do. Yeah. They're dependent on authority figures to tell them, you know, they're dependent. And some authority figure who they trust and who has served them well is telling them, if you love gay people, tell them they're going to hell. That's the way you love them. And so they're just trying to be good soldiers and do what they're told. And so what I'd recommend in that situation is that we just give people another alternative. We don't try to insult them or, you know, that's not going to help. I think we say, you know, I don't experience that as loving at all. I would feel really, if I were to say that, I would feel that I'm doing great harm. I would feel ashamed if I said something like that. I understand you don't, but that's how I would feel if I were speaking that way. And I think what that does is it doesn't just let things go unchallenged, but it also, it's not an attack. And what that does for that person, it gives them a gift. Someone who is nice to me modeled a different way of being loving. You know, and now that's data that is in my data set that I'll have to think about. It won't help right now but you know what it might do? It might sow doubt that my authority figures are telling me the only way that this can work.
I love it. Meredith has kind of a long paragraph. I'm going to read it because I can already tell that it's, I'm with you on this, Meredith. Meredith says, I've read, loved, and learned from all your books, but Faith After Doubt made me feel seen by you. Oh, I couldn't put it down. It was, for me too, it was a page turner. My doubt journey began on the heels of my son's coming out 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. At the time, I wasn't able to receive this as a gift, but I certainly do now. In fact, I've been able to see it as a kind of portal to seeing reality with different lenses. You made reference to this kind of thing on page 156 when you list old beliefs that begin to shine again, but in fresh ways. That is what keeps me coming back to faith again and again. Possibility that things that we might believe are of no value to us can and do actually shine again. What a perfect way to say it. Thank you.
Well, I love the way, what was her name?
Meredith.
I love the way Meredith said that. Oh, it's beautiful. It reminds me, someone said something to me the other day that I thought, I wish I would have put this in the book. In some ways, in stage three, everything becomes transparent. We start to see through it. But in stage four, everything starts to become radiant. We see that there's some light within it. And, you know, there are so many words and propositions and all that I grew up with in my Christian background that I came to see through. But then you go a few layers deeper and you realize, but you know, that was an attempt to solve a problem. And that problem is a real problem. That's a problem I want to solve too. I don't like that solution, but I'm really glad that some people tried to solve this problem. And you start to see something good there again.
Yeah. Jeff says, Peter Rollins suggests that living in conflict and antagonism are part of a Christian life and perhaps aren't meant to harmonize. Is harmony actually the act of embracing complexity, inviting it, and applying grace? I missed it there. And applying grace to it.
Yeah, well, I think I understand what Pete Rollins is saying, and I'm not contradicting him. In fact, I'm one of the surest ways to be hated is to love your enemies. Mm. I mean, the number of times people have expressed hatred for me, or I think of Meredith's comment, you know, when you genuinely have solidarity with LGBTQ people who other people want to stigmatize, as soon as you have solidarity with them, you're maybe even a bigger enemy to them than the LGBTQ community. So one of the surest ways to experience hatred is to be a person of radical, non-discriminatory love. So harmony doesn't mean that everybody likes you, but harmony means that the people who hate you, you come to a place where you might slip into hate from time to time. That's normal. We're human beings, but you never try to justify your hate. And you are willing to even be in opposition with other people, but you want to bear toward them nothing but compassion, nothing but goodwill. I'm really glad that someone is making that clarification.
You're just reminding me of the call to unity that we have been experienced in the last couple of months. Maybe we could talk about politics and Joe Biden and a call to unity, but you have just brought up for me a conversation that I've had on direct message over Facebook with somebody in our community who is calling me, not in my church, but just in our local community, who is calling me to Christian unity with him. And what that means for him is, how can you be open and affirming of LGBTQ people? You need to come and have Christian unity with me.
Yes. Which
for him means being loving our LGBTQ siblings, but also hating the sin.
Yes.
Is actually what I'm getting. And, you know, I'm seeing similar things in politics too, that unity means some kind of adjoining one group, the Orthodox group or something, over and against another group. And it just feels like it's a false sense of unity. I mean, yes. We could talk about Rene Girard all day long, you know, finding a sense of unity over and against others. But what does Christianity have to offer in that conversation? You're hitting. Yeah.
You know, I'm writing the sequel to Faith After Doubt right now. It's called Do I Stay Christian? And I was just writing a few days ago about a passage in the Gospels. I think it's Matthew 10 that, you know, I've never really paid this much attention to before, but it's where Jesus says, do not think I've come to bring peace on the earth, but a sword. And you know, that's very disturbing. And of course, all the worst people quote that as legitimizing carrying guns into the Capitol and having an insurrection or whatever. But then Jesus says, for I have come to set a son against his father, a daughter against her mother, a son-in-law against his mother-in-law, whatever. But it's every case. It's I've come to set the younger generation against the older generation. Isn't that interesting? And I don't think I ever really noticed that before. And he says, so the division, a person's opponents will be in his own family. And so what Jesus is saying is, look, if you accept my message, it's not going to make your life easier, because I'm asking you to doubt what people have heard said. And the older generation that is comfortable with that is going to stick with it and defend it. And they're going to see you as an enemy. But he says, but love your enemies, right? And so this to me is how change happens. In fact, it brings to mind, I hope you don't mind me sharing a quick story. I haven't thought of this in ages, but I was in South Africa some years ago and I was at a church and I was supposed to get picked up, and the people who picked me up were late. And the church groundskeeper came up to me. He's this big Dutch dude, you know, bald head, huge guy, a little older than me. And he starts talking to me. He's just friendly, outgoing, extroverted guy. And he says, can I tell you a story? And I wish I could imitate his accent. He said, I used to be a racist, he said. I was a full supporter of apartheid, he said. And he said, one day I was in an airport and I saw Desmond Tutu. And he said, I hated that man. I hated him with all of my being. And he said he was a very short man and I'm a very tall man. He said, and I walked past him and intentionally I bumped into him and I knocked him over. And he said, I leaned over him and I said, you're destroying our country. And Desmond Tutu, he said, looked up at him and said, God bless you, my brother. And the man said to me, I hated him even more. But I could never forget the love that he showed me when I was hateful toward him. And that's what began his change of heart, you know. And so that's to me how harmony works. It's the harmony that when you're struck, you don't strike back, you turn the other cheek, which is a way of saying you stand strong and nonviolent in your response.
Wow. Laura says, it was so freeing to no longer need an authority figure to tell me what is right or wrong, but it was also scary. I had been taught numerous times that humans are not able to think for themselves without being led astray.
That guy's pastor should have talked to Jesus, because when Jesus was getting ready to leave, he didn't say, I'm the only one who can tell you. So I'm now going to appoint Peter, and Peter's going to tell you what to think. He said, I no longer call you servants. I call you friends. I'm trying to lift you up to the area, to the level of a peer. And he says, it's better that I go away. When I go away, the Spirit will guide you. There's a lot you're not ready for now. You'll learn it when you're ready. He had this attitude. I think what Jesus was saying is, once you've been liberated from authoritarianism, you find out that the Spirit is present to teach you.
Yeah.
You couldn't hear it before because you're under this dome of authoritarianism. And so it is very, very liberating. And the best teachers, that's what they want for you. The best teachers want you to ask questions. They want you to think for yourself. So, yeah.
Speaking of teachers, Rick, who is a high school teacher, says, I like that description of love. I am a high school teacher. And a guiding insight for me has long been, people don't care about how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yes, yes, yes. That's one of those wise old sayings that I really cherish, and I think it's really true. Yeah.
April says, I have learned freedom of God through Clackamas UCC, hearing my father saying, you're still a sinner, when I came out as pansexual was disheartening, but I know the truth.
Yes. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. There it is. There it is. The younger generation, you know, is rejected by the older generation. And what a contrast between that response and Meredith, who over time learned to love her child as her child is. Yeah.
Amber says, Adam shakes his head enthusiastically, which I did throughout the book. So go get the book, everyone. It's fantastic. Amber also says, so much of my doubt stemmed from seeing people hurt, marginalized folks in the name of Jesus. How do we not become the thing that we hate in others, but from the other end of the spectrum?
Yeah, boy. Well, first let me say, Amber, the way Amber describes that, a lot of people don't understand that doubts are not all intellectual. It's not like just a thought thing. It's often an ethical thing. I don't like the way my religion is treating people. And that's an ethical doubt. I'm losing confidence in my religious community because of the way they treat people. And my gosh, Jesus pours all kinds of fuel on that fire. He says, it's by their fruits you shall know them. It's not by the words they say, it's by their fruits, you know? So I think that's a really important insight. Yeah, what was the last thing she said again?
How do we not become the thing we hate in others, but from the other end of the spectrum?
Yeah, so I think, Amber, the fact that you ask that question means you're already in a good place. Because when, well, the great and wild philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, beware when fighting the monster, lest you become the monster. And it is so easy, as I'm sure Adam often talks about, for us to mirror the bad behavior of others. And this is where, to me, being a Christian means when another person is hostile to me, rather than mirroring their behavior, I sort of turn my face towards somebody else. I want to see, well, how does Jesus live in these circumstances? And so I want to imitate his behavior rather than this other person's behavior.
I love it. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I've got one question that I need to ask you, which is something that we are struggling with a little bit here at Clackamas UCC, which you told in the story about, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, Charisse?
Yeah, it's Charis. Yeah.
Charis. Yeah. Like the spiritual gift Charis. Yes. I should have known that. So you had coffee with this woman, Charis, and talked with her about the future of the church, the future of Christianity, of how to live into not just harmony within ourselves, but stage four harmony as a congregation and what that means for us. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So here, I mean, there's so much we could say about this, Adam, but one way to say it is if you're a pastor or a priest or a leader and you're in stage one, you can't lead people from anywhere other than where you are. It's not your fault. That's just where you are. And unfortunately, a lot of our religious communities train people to be stage one and tell them you can never go beyond this, right? And some whole denominations, you are not allowed to be anything other than a stage person, stage one. That's their understanding of Christianity. And then there are other people, maybe you get to stage two, and they allow people to get to that stage. There are very, and I should say, many of our denominations, if you go to seminary, you get introduced to stage three. But in the local church, it's stage two and below. And we don't know what it looks like to have significant numbers of pastors leading from stage four. We don't know what that looks like yet, but I have a suspicion that as more and more people lead from that place and in a sense come out of the closet of actually being what they are inside, I think what we'll see is that will lead to change. And in fact, some of the struggles in the Methodist denomination are because more and more people who were leaders in stage three, and they were willing to challenge some of the things in stages one and two. And more are in stage four, and that brings about change. And in that way, the stage one and stage two folks who can't accept that and would rather split away because of it, you have to say, well, I understand why you would do that. You know, it's the only response you can have based on how you see things. Makes total sense.
Yeah. Last comment I want to read is by my friend, Eric Byes, who's in Europe. Eric says, I will remember this. Doubt is not the enemy of faith. Doubt is the enemy of authoritarianism. And it says, great, inspiring testimony. Thank you both very much for this. Brian, thank you for your time. You are always so generous. And Brian has a warm, gentle, smart, compassionate spirit. We didn't even get into the science of belonging and all of the other wonderful things in this book, even though we've talked for about 50 minutes. Please get this book. I may make it required reading for my congregation because it's just fantastic. Faith After Doubt. So, Brian, thank you so much for being here. It's always a pleasure and an honor to talk with you. So thank you.
Well, I honor you and the good work you're doing and these wonderful folks who came together for this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for being here and for your comments and your questions. Your faith and your doubt are always welcome here at One Question with Pastor Adam. So, friends, until next week, Thursday at 1 o'clock here on the Clackamas UCC Facebook page and the Raven Foundation Facebook page, until next time, God be with you.